brings me great pleasure to welcome an author. He's also the director of editorial content here at WBGO and contributes to NPR Music across the board. Nate Shenin has a new book, Plane Changes, Jazz for the New Century. And we're going to be talking about that book, but also we've constructed a playlist for you of some of our favorite recordings that will tell the narrative of 2018. And one thing that I can safely say and be extremely excited about is, has there ever been a wider spectrum of sound to come from the tradition we call jazz?
I don't know. It's pretty wide. It's pretty diverse. And, you know, things happening on multiple frequencies and multiple registers. It's exciting.
Well, between these deep cuts that we're going to be sharing with you today, I'll also be dropping some bombs, hopefully, intellectual bombs with Nate Shenin here in our studio as we try to...
What is this, Kenny Clark hour?
We love Kenny Clark. Let's begin with our first recording, somebody that we've both spent a considerable time thinking about and writing about. I'm sure you'll recognize it. What we're listening to right now is Heaven and Earth by the one and only Kamasi Washington, now signed to the Young Turks label, but formerly of Brain Feeder, where he came to prominence, and the Space Traveler's Lullaby, one of my favorite tracks on this recording.
It's a good track. This album, I think, really moves the needle forward for Kamasi Washington. I felt like there were certain things that the epic proposed, and I feel that Heaven and Earth really fulfills on a lot of that promise. You know, I've been waiting for this album.
Plus, the record just sounds better, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, he's been a real road warrior. Very few jazz musicians have been able to maintain the kind of touring schedule that Kamasi has maintained, and it's a real privilege that he's been able to work as much as he has. And, you know, in the process, this band has really become super tight. You know, so this album captures them really in high gear. You know, you and I both saw them in concert this year also, and it's a machine, you know, in a good way. They really have, like, all the pieces are in place, and Kamasi really knows how to lead that band.
You open your book, Plane Changes, Jazz for the New Century, with Kamasi Washington as sort of the symbol of where this music is headed. And we spoke briefly outside, and one of the things that you were curious about when you spoke to me about it was this little section right here, which I will just read to you. There was no question that Washington exerts a commanding presence with his horn, but he seemed to be the rare example of a major arrival in jazz who brings no new vocabulary or inflection to his instrument, which I thought was an interesting point to make and makes me think about jazz a little bit more holistically. Does it even matter that an individual soloist has a sound anymore? Or have we grown to a point in the music where the sound is something more holistic, maybe?
That's an interesting question. I really grappled with how to present Kamasi because I greatly admire Kamasi Washington, but I'm not 100% in the tank for him. I have my various quibbles and ambivalences. You know, often when I encounter his playing, I enjoy it, I appreciate it, but it doesn't necessarily move me, and I don't feel that I'm hearing a new vocabulary or, you know.
You're not hearing Mary Halverson, for instance.
No, I mean, but there are plenty of other even tenor players that we could talk about. And what was really crucial to me in terms of getting on board with Kamasi's whole thing is just setting aside some of those criteria, you know, and saying, this is an important artist, even if he doesn't check off some of the boxes that we usually favor when we're talking about a new arrival in jazz. I don't think it's less important to have an individual voice. And when you talk about some of the artists that I get excited about, whether it's Ambrose Akinmusiri or Mary Halverson or Marcus Gilmore, we do talk about the individuality that is expressed through an individual's performance, right? That's still a big part of the picture. With Kamasi, it is a bigger proposition. And I really think that when you talk about his sound, you have to talk about the sound of this, like, Mack truck of a band that he has. You know, it's they're sort of inseparable.
You have to talk about the two drummers. You have to talk about the string section.
Absolutely.
And sometimes two keyboardists, sometimes two bass players.
It's a real wall of sound. You know, when I saw the band recently at Brooklyn Steel, it's a cathartic kind of experience. It's fun. People were super into it, but it's relentless. You know, the thing that I find myself missing when I submit to the Kamasi Washington live experience is a sense of that dynamic range that you get from a jazz performance and that you even honestly get from his albums. Heaven and Earth is a really varied listening experience. It has ups and downs. The live show is really kind of like just being nailed against the wall. But in a way, that's not what they're about, and that's not what their audiences are interested in. You know, it's clearly working. Look at the phenomenon of Kamasi Washington and the way in which he's framed as a sort of messianic figure. And to me, the questions around that were really interesting.
Have you figured out his success? Do you understand it fully,
no,
even now?
I don't think he understands it fully. I mean, it was a celestial alignment. I mean, when have we seen something like that? You know, I mean, it's really remarkable.
I mean, I would almost make the case about Brainfeeder and that label in particular, as it approaches the genre of jazz. That might have been more important than we give it credit to. The fact that Flying Lotus released the album, not under the moniker of jazz, period.
Sure. Well, when something is connected to a source of subcultural capital, you know, when it's cool from the start, that always helps. And I think that Kamasi's affiliations certently with Kendrick Lamar, with Snoop Dogg, those were also really helpful. So yeah, it's a whole series of factors. I do think that Brainfeeder is sort of its own creative universe. It has its own following. I know you're a big Thundercat guy. You know, there's a lot of creative energy around that. Lewis Cole, you know, there's just a lot of stuff happening under the Brainfeeder umbrella. And a lot of it doesn't fit under the rubric of jazz, and that's fine.
Well, let's continue to move on with another artist that you just brought up in this conversation that I think is kind of important and also figures nicely in your book, Playing Changes, Jazz for the New Century, Nate Shannon, which is really a book about how jazz grapples with its tradition in our current period, really.
Yeah, I would say it's the idea of jazz in a broader culture. You know, what is jazz's relationship to the world in which we live, to the larger cultural conversation? What are the forces at work there? You know, it's all of that.
So what you're listening to right now is Lewis Cole, who we just mentioned, signed to the Brainfeeder label. Not necessarily would qualify himself in the jazz tradition, but frequently performs with so many jazz musicians based in the LA area. And right there, a cameo from the one and only Brad Meldow, a pianist that I would almost never even imagine participating in a scenario like this.
Brad knows what's up. Brad has been interested in groove for a while, you know, and you and I have talked about his duo collaboration with Mark Juliana. He's interested in people who are shaking things up, you know, from the foundation, you know. And I think that Lewis Cole is an interesting case because he clearly is such a savant, you know, like he understands production, he understands the mechanics of rhythm and harmony, you know. How it all comes out, it's like it's so blenderized. I'm not 100% on board with the aesthetic all the time, but he's, you know, crazy, crazy talented, clearly.
Is this an artist that you think we should claim as a jazz musician? Is this a jazz record?
I don't think so, but that's fine. You know, it's jazz adjacent, you know, which is what you could say about a lot of stuff that we're interested in. But this is the thing too. I'm sort of tired of the question. I'm not that interested in deciding what is in or out of the encampment.
But I feel like as a critic and as somebody that's been brought up, especially during the 80s and 90s, and even before that in the 70s, when the tradition of jazz became such a governing force in shaping in the way how we talk about the music and frame the music, it is unavoidable.
Well, this is a big topic that I attempted to cover in my book, which is sort of our transition out of an era in which definition was the ruling mandate, you know? Because, yeah, you know, you and I came up with the music at a time when that was the conversation. How do you define the music? What then is excluded from the jazz designation? Why is it important to draw that perimeter? It had an impact on the reception around the music, on the business of the music, and certainly on the development of an aesthetic. One of the happiest outcomes of, you know, the music's evolution is that we can still have that conversation, but it's no longer ruling the whole ecology of the art form. What? I don't think younger musicians are as obsessed about whether they're playing jazz or not. It doesn't seem as relevant.
The most relevant artist, like Shabaka Hutchings, who we'll get to in this playlist, thinks we should just go away with all of that. He's done with the political correctness of how to talk about this music.
It kind of goes into my thoughts about jazz and about the tradition of jazz and how it should progress in that I kind of see myself as a part of a moving tradition where we can't assume that the world is going to go on indefinitely. It seems to be a finite point at the moment in time that we're in. You know, there's no time for considering. There's no time for trying to build up the canon in the way that it was before. You just do what you want. You do what you feel. We go to raves. We love jazz music. We love trance music. We love punk music. We just feel like we're going to get all that stuff out now because there's not time to be considering the niceties and how we place things and what the meaning of where we are in the grand tradition. It's like, no, we like music, we play it.
I do think that there's a stultifying framework that amounts to a form of received wisdom. And, you know, for an artist like Shabaka, like he's doing something that feels vital and personal. And so why should that have to be litigated in terms of who does he sound like? Is he, you know, exhibiting full command of the post-Coltrane harmonic vocabulary, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's the basic question is, does this music move you? And I think for many people, when it comes to Shabaka, the answer is yes.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Shabaka Hutchings on a recording that you highlight as one of the best of 2018. We're speaking to Nate Shannon. We're listening to right now Kai McCraven, Universal Beings. How often do you get to hear a tenor saxophone played with a cello like that, spliced up in a live recording? It's not a live recording. What is this recording, Nate Shannon?
Well, Kai McCraven is a wonderful drummer. He's a great jazz drummer, but he is much more than that. And he has developed this sort of working method that involves sort of spontaneous, collective improvisation. I don't know that you would call it free jazz, because it's very rhythmic, it's very tonal. You know, it's basically musicians finding a groove together and developing that groove. And then he takes that raw material and basically treats it the way that a hip-hop producer would treat it, making splices, you know, reformulating, reshaping. And so this album, Universal Beings, draws on four separate sessions in four different cities. This one with the British saxophonist Shabaka Hutchings actually was recorded in Chicago. I'm not sure how you would classify this album. Is it a sort of instrumental hip-hop jam album? You know, is it
exactly?
Is it, and honestly, that's
and it's tribal. is it tribal jazz? Maybe we can just call it that.
In a certain way, yeah. The labels are confounding and honestly beside the point. Makaya's and his label's term for it is organic beat music, which I think is as valid a phrase as any. You know, it is music that could not have been made by anyone other than improvising jazz musicians. And whether you call it jazz or not is of no real concern. But the musicians playing this music are coming out of the jazz tradition, and they're finding communion.
Well, you can see Makaya McCraven's Universal Beings with Shabaka Hutchings and so many of these other artists, including Junius Paul, who you just heard. Tamika Reid will not be there. However, Brandy Younger will, and Jeff Parker will, and Nubia Garcia will. It's Red Bull Music presents Makaya McCraven at Le Poisson Rouge on Sunday, December 2nd. And that should be quite an event. And what we just heard was Atlantic Black. Sweet House, featuring Nubia Garcia. Also just tremendous replayable track. Nate Shannon joins us here on The Checkout, speaking about Jazz in 2018 and his book, Playing Changes, Jazz for the New Century. I want to go back to Brad Meldow a little bit, just because you talk about, you dedicate almost a whole chapter to him in your book as sort of like one of these really interesting figures that exemplifies this changing in the way we think about the music and define the music. And you compared him to David Foster Wallace, which I thought was an excellent comparison. This is actually A.O. Scott describing David Foster Wallace's attributes being hyper-articulate, plaintive, self-mocking, diffident, overbearing, needy, ironical, and almost pathologically self-aware. And you attribute all of those kind of characteristics to Brad Meldow, which is really interesting because that's sort of where we're at today, right?
Brad is the first person to identify himself as part of a Generation X cohort. And so in thinking about him, when I encountered that passage about Foster Wallace, I thought, you know, this really, there is a certain resonance there. And part of it has to do with the kind of existential struggle that Meldow certainly went through, and I think a lot of musicians of his generation as well, which was, you know, coming up in this era of really a kind of strong traditionalist emphasis. You know, some people call it a neoconservative era or a neoclassical era, but this idea that to be a jazz musician is to be basically repeating, recycling the past, re-embodying the past, you know? And so what place is there for personal expression if you're effectively, you know, reenacting history all the time? And he found his own way to you know, break free of that grid without running away from it. You know, it's like he was able to just like loosen the space and create a lane for himself. And part of that involved just repertoire. Choosing to play songs by some of the grunge bands that he came up with, you know, playing songs by Radiohead, most famously.
Or my personal favorite, the Nick Drake Riverman.
Yeah. Thinking about the material, you know, that it's not always about the songbook standards or the jazz standards. But another thing was personalizing rhythm too. You know, there's a rhythmic, there's sort of a floating rhythmic feeling to the first Brad Meldow trio that was really distinct. That was really, really influential, you know, just the way that band interacted. It's had a long influence.
We're here with Nation N. He's speaking at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. He's moderating a panel reviewing A Year in Jazz 2018 with Kira Grunenberg, Ethan Iverson, Matthew Castle, and John Mirth. We hope to see you there. We're also going to be live streaming that conversation if you can't be there on December 5th at 7 p.m. at wbgo.org. And actually, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about today, we're not talking about in the panel. You won't be talking about it in the panel.
We've got a lot of ground to cover, so I don't think you have to worry about redundancy there.
Man, the soul is a factory. Cooking the actions up.
Well, let's move on to some more music here of 2018 that we both love so much. This one trumpeter has certainly created a lane for himself and definitely exemplifies what this music sounds like today. Ambrosac and Musiri.
Burying sons, daughters, the snarl, the snarling darlings, left in the moonlight, learning to fend for themselves. The shuddering, stuttering, sputtering, muttering, prayers, chants, incantations, curses, blessings, hymns, and sayings, craven idols, neon tapestries. Cash call grinning in shallow holloway. Carrots dangled over the balconies. Fox hunts through the halls of academies. The paint peel off of the wall, the hot heat of the bonfire. Skin is a strong paper. The drum is the first and the last meal. The drip of the blood in the wine glass, the dying to the howl, the sweet, horrible backdrop.
I really feel like the trumpeter Ambrose Akinmusiri is reaching a new pinnacle of creativity, first and foremost, with this new recording, Origami Harvest, on Blue Note. It also reminds me a lot of actually another trumpeter that put out a very impressive recording that made many top lists, Christian Scott's trilogy. Talk to us about Ambrose Akinmusiri and his blossoming as just an artist.
Well, it's no secret that I'm a fan of Ambrose Akinmusiri. I've really liked all of his albums. This one is in a place of its own. I would go so far as to say that this album is a masterpiece. The amount of synthesis that he's able to accomplish here, really sophisticated writing for string quartet, really thoughtful incorporation of electronic music and, you know, next level chamber jazz improvising. And then, of course, a really sort of seamless integration of rapping by Kool AD of Das Racist with a strong thematic framework, which is, you know, basically injustices committed against people of color in this country, you know, notably but not exclusively by the police and by, you know, our institutions. And so if you think about all of the elements, all of the moving parts on this album, it should not work. It's wildly, like, crazily ambitious. And the way that it all comes together, I still don't really know how he accomplished it. You know, it's a real achievement, and it shows more than a mind at work. It just shows that he's an incredibly careful and thoughtful band leader, composer, sort of marshaller of resources. But it doesn't feel overworked either, you know. For all of the care that went into this album, it kind of feels breezy and inevitable, you know? So that's a magic trick to me. I got this feeling that just won't go away. The kind of notion that would lead some astray. An intuition from the eternal flame. Nation N joins us as we reflect on a year of jazz 2018, and he'll be moderating a panel speaking about that subject on Wednesday, December 5th at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. Joining him, Kira Grunberg, Ethan Iverson, Matthew Castle, and John Murph, which I'm sure will be an enlightening discussion about the music and the players that are making it. It's so funny listening to this wide variety of sounds coming out of the jazz tradition. I kept thinking while reading your book, Playing Changes, of that jazz tree that you used to see in all the walls, but with all your colleagues. And I look at that and I almost look at it in kind of like, oh, that's cute, because that tree has almost turned into a wildlife, you know, reserve of Yellowstone proportions. people are fascinated by lineage, you know, and sort of this leads to this leads to this. And you can do that today, but it's a lot more complicated. And I think that the linearity of that idea, I think it's wildly oversimplified.
So let's go into a more simplified recording by an artist we're both extremely fond of, but there's nothing really simple about this music at all. This is called The Trickster. Aaron Park's Little Big will be coming to Le Poisson Rouge on Wednesday, December 19th, and also to our WBGO studios for a future session to celebrate this Rope-A-Dope release. Aaron Parks, the pianist, expanding his range also.
You know, this album, I kept going back to it. You know, it just sounds so good. And part of that is he entrusted the engineering and the mixing to a couple of people who you know, primarily work in indie rock. One of them is Chris Taylor of Grizzly Bear. I went and saw Grizzly Bear, I think about a year ago, and I ran into Aaron Parks at the beer table. So this music is not, he's not making a move here. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to make my indie jazz record, you know. This, he really feels this music, and this band is so on one page together, you know. It's really a really cohesive sound. His ear for melody and dynamics, and sort of the way that he uses atmosphere as almost a plot device, you know, it's a really, really smartly realized album. And to me, you know, we're well into this phase of jazz musicians emulating, you know, indie rock dynamics. It's nothing new. And so the idea that Aaron Parks could deliver an album that feels so incredibly fresh and heartfelt and genuine and kind of stirring, you know, I was really impressed by this.
One thing that I always notice about jazz as it embraces technology specifically and electronic instruments is this thing that you mentioned previously about having a lack in dynamics. But I feel like every year that passes, musicians are getting better at that. They're finding ways to find the dynamics in a more electronic setting. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that to be a really fully functioning jazz musician, you know, dynamics are a big part of that picture. And so then if you're going on to explore, you know, hybridizing your music with other forms, why would you not, you know, impose that sort of same standard? And so, yeah, I think... it's all about fluencies and competencies, you know, and some of this blending now feels completely second nature, you know, certainly to the generation of musicians that are coming up.
Let's listen to another incredibly loud band, but also plays with a tremendous amount of dynamics. Actually, we premiered this ensemble, celebrating their release party at New Blue in late June, and he also is the drummer for Thundercat. We're listening to Justin Brown's Niosi. That is the name of his debut release on Biophilia. And that is Replenish. You feel replenished, Nate, after hearing that?
Yeah, I feel like I just came out of an electronic spa. But, you know, I think this album is really interesting. It's sort of, I don't think we talk about fusion enough. Jason Lindner is one of the keyboardists on this album. And
who also has a great record, The Buffering Cocoon.
He does. And, you know, it's pretty much anything he touches is worth hearing. This album is really, really well executed. And it's interesting how much effort has clearly gone into the idea of streamlining these ideas. You know, Justin could have made a crazy chops record, you know, where it's just like drums out front. And that's really not the case with Niosi. You know, it's a pretty melodic effort. But to me, when I hear it, it feels like a next wave of fusion. I don't think about it in terms of electronic music so much. It really feels related to like the jazz rock of the 70s and you know, and early 80s, like, you know, the sort of Weather Report sonic frontierism, you know. But at the same time, it's not trying to belong to that trajectory. It feels to me like a logical next step for the music that we often call fusion.
Nation, and what Samora Pinderhughes posed to me in his session here at WBGO, proclaiming genre itself is dead. Do you agree with that?
No. Genre is a sort of industry construct, and it still has its supporters. I do think that the idea of genre is permeable and pliable in a way that it hasn't been, you know. Talk about the fact that a strong contender for album of the year in pop is a Kacey Musgraves album, Golden Hour, which nominally is a country album, you know, but it doesn't sound like one. It's got, you know, disco on it. So, I mean, there is a sort of plasticity of genre, but genre persists as an organizing principle, you know, for this industry. I think that for an artist, thinking in terms of creating music, it's useful to argue that genre no longer exists, because that's not the artist's job to think in those terms. It's a useful terminology for the sorts of people who work in the music industry and sometimes for consumers. But I think it's healthy for an artist to basically ignore that idea.
Why did you decide to end your book on Mary Halverson?
Well, she is of the musicians that receive a sort of profile treatment in the book. She is the sort of newest arrival. It's been basically a decade since she released her first album as a bandleader composer. And in that time, she has emerged as the real genuine article. Someone with an unmistakable instrumental voice, with what seems to be an endless reserve of ideas and creative resources. She's always changing the formula for herself, but you would never hear her and mistake her for anybody else. And so she illuminates for me the emergence of this new wave or generation of musicians who are really coming out of the avant-garde, but quite interested in interrogating their relationship to the jazz tradition. It felt like a real significant moment when Mary played her first week at the Village Vanguard. And that's the opening scene of that chapter in the book. There was a real kind of frisson in the room. It felt like, is this really happening? You know, is this going to work? It's exciting to think that, you know, she's now in her 30s and she's really sort of just getting started. She's done so much. And this album, Code Girl, which is a really substantial I won't call it a departure for her, but it's a left turn of sorts, you know, because it is her foray into songwriting, into music with words. It's blending different approaches. We've already mentioned Ambrose Akinmusiri. He's on this album, along with Toma Fujiwara on drums and Michael Formanek on bass, and crucially, Amirtha Kidambi on vocals. And so it's like, once again, we run into this classification problem. Is this sort of like a jazz-inflected indie rock album? Is it an art rock project? Is it avant-garde jazz? You know, the answer is sort of yes and no to all of the above.
Nation, and thank you so much for joining us, and definitely check them out on December 5th at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on 58 West 129th Street. Joining him, Kira Grunenberg, Ethan Iverson, Matthew Castle, John Murph, speaking about A Year in Jazz. Thank you.
Thanks, Simon.